Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hello there and welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. How are you? Hope you're well. Are you in the middle of World Cup fever? Well, I mean, it's only just started, in fairness. I'm coming up here to record on Thursday evening just after the opening game. Russia beat Saudi Arabia 5-0. I have to admit, I went out at 3-0. I'd kind of seen enough at that point. It was not the greatest game of football I've ever watched. So it was time to walk the dogs, and by the time I got back, game was over. Russia had scored another two goals. Pretty great way to start the World Cup if you're the host of the tournament. 5-0 win at home. Everybody's happy. There was a lot of talk, wasn't there, about the Russian team being over the hill and too old and destined to fail and all that kind of stuff. But 5-0. That's all right. You can deal with that. If you're a Russian fan, I'm sure you're very, very happy this evening. Not so much if you're a Saudi Arabia fan, but I don't know what your expectation would have been going into that game. Hopefully there's better to come in terms of the football on display during the rest of this World Cup. There's some good games tomorrow. Uruguay-Egypt, I think, is on. Portugal-Spain, that should be a good one. But I think we've had one of the images of the World Cup so far. When the first Russian goal went in, the cameras cut to the stands, and there, sitting in the middle, is Gianni Infantino, who is, of course, the president of FIFA. To one side of him is Vladimir Putin, and to the other side of him is the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, whose name is, and I did look this up, Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud. I hope I've said that correctly. And he's looking, going, oh, well, that wasn't great. God, no, we don't pay these guys the big bucks to defend like that. And Infantino is in the middle going, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And Putin is there going, sorry about that, mate. Sorry about that. And then they lean across and they have this handshake, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia and the Russian President Vladimir Putin, while the guy from FIFA sits in the middle. And they're basically shaking hands across his groin, his groinal area. And I think if somebody were to paint that picture, if it had been painted in the 1600s or during the Renaissance, art historians and art critics would tell us all the significance of this. These two powerful men shaking hands, obscuring the very manhood of the man whose organization is in charge of this tournament, as if to say, you will do our bidding. You will do what we want you to do, because we, at any point, we can take away your genitals, that which makes you a man. We are the ones who control that. Maybe I'm overthinking that just a little bit, but when that image came up on the screen, I was thinking, oh, well, this is what the World Cup is. This is what football is. It's powerful men. And look at them. Look, they are human. They feel things. Look, they're displaying some kind of emotion that we can recognize. But we all know it's part of an act. It's all a sham. It's all a big swizz. We know they don't feel anything deep down inside. This is just power games. They don't care one way or the other whether the football team wins or not. Not like fans and people from the... They don't care. You know they don't care. Anyway, the World Cup is underway and we'll see where it takes us over the next few weeks. Despite the fact there's not a great deal of Arsenal going on, it is a busy show today. In a few moments' time, I'm going to be talking to James Horncastle, who will be here to tell us all about the potential new signing. We believe it's almost done, but given the way things have gone this summer, chances are we'll do this whole podcast on this guy. And Lucas Torreira, by the way, is the guy I'm talking about. We'll do a whole podcast episode on him, and then he'll sign for somebody else the minute I put this podcast up. That's the way things have been going so far, but we will be talking to James about that, about the World Cup as well. And a bit later on, we have got some Arsenal history for you. If you thought the history of Arsenal was absolutely set in stone and there was nothing new under the sun, well, you're going to have to think again, because there is a brand new book out called Royal Arsenal, Champions of the South, written by Mark Andrews, Andy Kelly, and our very own columnist here on arseblog.com, Tim Stillman. The book uncovers all kinds of new stuff about Arsenal, its history. It deconstructs some of the stuff that's out there at the moment. Is it true? Is it not? And it's a really fascinating piece of work. So I'm going to be talking to those three guys as well. A little bit of Arsenal history. Anyway, as I said, though, Lucas Torreira, a 22-year-old defensive midfielder coming in from Sampdoria, a fee believed to be in the region of £30 million. What kind of a player is he? How has he been performing for Sampdoria? What can he bring to the Arsenal side? What kind of a system does he fit into? All that and much more with somebody who knows all about him. It's James Horncastle. Hi, James.
Hey, Andrew.
Let's talk a little bit about this guy. He came to Italy at a fairly young age. He was only maybe 17 or 18 when he joined Pescara, I think, the youth team there.
Yeah, they found him from Santiago Wanderers in Uruguay, which is a great name for a football team. And he went into the youth system in Pescara and was coached by the brother of Marco Giampaolo, who is his current coach at Sampdoria. And the unusual thing, I suppose, about Torreira is that background at Pescara has drawn many comparisons with Marco Verratti, who is also from there and has had this kind of similar trajectory in his career, in that Verratti was a number 10 when he was growing up, and with time, you know, he became a deep line playmaker, and was switched to that position a little bit like Andrea Pirlo was when he was at Brescia.
Yeah.
But Torreira really sort of started to catch people's attention when Pescara got promoted to Serie A a couple of years ago under the former Milan and Lazio fullback Massimo Oddo, 2006 World Cup winner. He was very impressive in the playoffs that got them into the top flight, particularly against Trapani when he was playing just in front of the defence. And Sampdoria had some scouts at that game, and they decided there and then that they absolutely had to have this player, because at a young age it was clear that he had a great kind of personality. He was not afraid to get on the ball and to really be the kind of the straw that stirs the drink for that team.
When we look at defensive midfielders, particularly in England, I think there's a desire, maybe we've moved away from it a little bit, but a desire to see a big guy, someone powerful, somebody who can put themselves about, you know, cope with the rigors of English football, the physicality that has long been the hallmark of English football in many ways. I know many Arsenal fans, there's a hankering for somebody who, you know, maybe isn't dissimilar from Patrick Vieira. I don't think you can keep looking back that way. You've got to accept that Vieira was a once-in-a-lifetime player, and if you keep trying to find the new Vieira, you're going to come up short every single time. But at 5'6", just about 5'6", Torreira is not quite in that mold, and maybe is a bit smaller than people would expect for a player playing in that kind of a position. So how is he used in the Sampdoria midfield, and what, if anything, do they do perhaps to offset some of the physical limitations he might have in terms of height and winning aerial balls?
Okay, well, I think this is a role that is more common in Italian football than it is in England. The idea of having this regista, the director, in front of the defence, someone who can slow the game down but speed it up as well, someone who you essentially play through and you rely upon to get your attacking game going. I think it's actually quite curious that this summer, Andrew, we're seeing a lot of interest from Premier League sides in players who basically perform this role. There is an expectation that Manchester City will sign Jorginho, who is a very much a similar player to Torreira, who essentially is there to knit things together to organize play and give his team a tempo. Now, the interesting thing about Torreira is that, as you say, he's quite a diminutive player, albeit he's quite stocky as well. He's got quite the arse on him. is that he's pretty resilient in his ability to hold the ball and shield the ball from even bigger, more physical opponents. An example that comes to mind. I watched him play live this season against Milan, and they had a guy called Frank Kessier, who's an Ivorian midfield player, who's much taller, a statue of rippling muscle, and Torreira was able to kind of resist the challenges and elude the challenges with that kind of low center of gravity that he's got. I think one of the things that stands out about him as well is that a lot of people are very keen to make these kind of comparisons, which I must say I confess I made myself earlier with Verratti and Pirlo. But he is someone who actually is a ball winner as well. And he uses, for example, his ability to kind of read the game to do that. But he's not afraid to kind of throw himself about as well. He's quite a dynamic player. You'll see him throwing himself into challenges. He's pretty resolute and robust in coming away with the ball. I think the thing that I look at with this move to Arsenal is that he plays in a very, very well organized, quite specific system, which is he basically plays in a 4-4-2 diamond with two midfield players either side who are very dynamic. Do a lot of running for him, because ultimately Torreira lets the ball do the running. And you will probably see over the next few days stats which show him covering more ground than any other player. But that was very similar to Pirlo as well for his team. Except we don't think of Pirlo as being the most dynamic player. I think it shows that Torreira is always on the move. And the great thing about that system for him is that he's always got multiple kind of passing angles. He's got guys either side of him who he can go to if he wants to, but he's also got 10 in front of him who he can play to as well, and that helps. So I'm curious to see what Unai Emery does with him, because I haven't seen him. He's never played in sort of a two in midfield. He's always had players either side of him and someone ahead of him. So, in that respect, it'll be interesting to see if Arsenal, will be playing with three there next season.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the scope when you talk about a 4-4-2 diamond, you could think of two midfielders doing the job that the guys at Sampdoria are doing in Mesut Ozil, for example, as the 10. But what we do know, I think, is from what people are saying, certainly it's been mentioned a few times, is that Emery is going to play a high-pressing game, a high-energy game, and that primarily starts in midfield. So it does feel like that's something that he'd be able to fit into pretty well.
Yeah, this is a guy who won the ball back more times than any other player in Serie A last season, which, again, just to look at him is a bit surprising.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned his height. He doesn't look the most physical, but I think this again comes from a vision of play, which on the one hand is when he's got the ball, and on the other it's knowing what other players on the opposing side are going to do with the ball, that helps him in that regard. He's a really interesting player to watch, because I mean, look, he's still only 22. I think this represents a really good bargain for Arsenal in many respects, because what they're going to pay, 10 million every year for the next 3 years for him. So they're able to stagger the payments. And this guy's got a lot of upside, a lot of potential, because, again, if you look at kind of all the other if you look at all the other metrics, which kind of look to break down his game, you know, this is a guy who sort of averages, I think, sort of 66 passes per 90 minutes, which is again behind what you see Jorginho doing, which is, you know, in excess of 100. You know, he's not as accurate with the ball as, you know, someone like Borja Valero, who was once of West Brom, but has since made a pretty good career for himself in Italy. You know, he doesn't make as many assists or sort of key passes as Miralem Pjanic, but there are all the kind of tools there for Arsenal to have a guy who can basically, you know, you can give him the keys to the team, and he can drive whatever passing game they have. I wonder if Emery looks at him and thinks, you know, this guy can be my Ava Benega, the guy I had at Sevilla.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly will be interesting to see how he's deployed, but it feels like a move that is in some ways made to reconfigure the Arsenal midfield, because it has been a little bit all over the place in recent seasons. You know, the various combinations, whether it's two or three, Arsene Wenger struggled to get them working. So this is certainly going in a different direction. Maybe this is me being short-sighted or somewhat stereotypical, but is there something of the South American in him in terms of how he plays? Because again, I spoke last week to Paolo Bandini about Stefan Lichtsteiner, who has a bit of a reputation for cynicism, you know, being that kind of a player, an experienced player. Let's say he knows when to make a tackle or knows when to make a foul. And those are qualities sometimes that are present in South American players. I'm kind of for it because Arsenal have been a very nice team and have been lacking that. So is there any of that in him?
No, I don't think so. I think what's interesting about Torreira again, and this fits in with the Uruguay side we'll probably see this evening play in the World Cup, is that, you know, their midfield goes against you know, what we've grown accustomed to from Uruguay. He's not a kind of snarling kind of Yorkshire Terrier. You know, sort of getting after and biting players' ankles. You know, I think on the contrary, he's one of the most fouled players in Italy last season. So, you know, I think if you look at his disciplinary record, he was booked only six times, hardly missed any games, which, you know, I think, you know, from Arsenal's point of view, is maybe comes as relief after watching Granit Xhaka over the last year. So in that respect, he's a bit different. I think, you know, it's you're not going to see any kind of crazy Copa Libertadores sort of, you know, ripping his shirt off and getting into brawls, which, you know, is might come as a bit of a disappointment for you, Andrew.
Yeah, it is a bit. It is a bit. I'm good at now. I was looking forward to some of that, but maybe he'll grow into it. He appears to be a fairly durable player as well, in the sense that he made 36 starts for Sampdoria last season, 35 the season before. Fitness has been a problem for Arsenal's midfield at times, so that's another plus, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I mean, he's been playing at clubs that haven't been competing in Europe and don't have a fourth competition in the League Cup, let's say.
Yeah.
Which we see in the Premier League. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how he gets to grips with that. Obviously, in Italy, they have a winter break as well, which is not something that he's going to have in England, at least until, what, two seasons, I think. We've seen they're announcing a change for a winter break coming up, at least in the Premier League. And they didn't... they didn't really make any kind of inroads in the Coppa Italia over the last couple of years as well. So, yeah, he's mainly been allowed to just focus on the league and kind of have played one game a week, which, you know, I think is going to change. But yeah, certainly he hasn't had any kind of fitness issues. I think that would have been a big plus when Arsenal came to kind of signing off on this deal. You know, we haven't seen him, you know, suffer any bad knee injuries in the past. What I can say is that, you know, for all the stereotypes that there are about Italian football being a slower paced game, When you play in the second division, like he did, that's a pretty agricultural, tricky, hard hitting league to be in. You know, where you play. I mean, what, the Serie B playoffs are still going on at the moment, and there's the World Cup started. So it's an awful long season. You know, which he was able to kind of resist. And, you know, I think, again, as you were talking about that kind of high pressing game that Unai Emery wants to bring to Arsenal, Samp play very easy on the eye, but quite avant-garde system in Italy. Marco Giampaolo, the manager there, is very much seen as a chip off Maurizio Sarri's block. The Napoli manager, yeah, who's drawn so many plaudits from the likes of Pep Guardiola this season. You know, who like to play high up the pitch, win the ball back. They're very compact. Samp is seen as the other side to that. In fact, Giampaolo replaced Maurizio Sarri at Sarri's recommendation at Empoli, and then got the Sampdoria job on the back of that. And it was a bit of a surprise that when Napoli decided to part ways without parting ways with Maurizio Sarri by firing him but keeping him under contract, that Giampaolo didn't get the job there, because Giampaolo is seen as very much a continuity guy. And, I think, that was probably one of the principal rivals that Arsenal had to Torreira's signature was from Napoli. You were looking to replace, anticipating that they'll have to replace Jorginho. So, you know, I think, again, in that respect, you know, he's resilient enough, although it will be a different challenge for him, the rigors of the Premier League. He should fit in with how Emery wants this Arsenal team to play.
Excellent. I do like the idea of a football club or a team being described as avant-garde. We don't get enough of that when it comes to analysing football teams and their styles. Nicely done in that regard. Very quickly, just a quick chat about World Cup. Obviously started last night. How are you viewing this tournament? You know, perhaps when the award of this World Cup was made to Russia, and shortly afterwards the one to Qatar, there was rightly, I think, an amount of cynicism about how some of the decisions were made. But can you put that to one side? Do you find it easy to put that to one side? Or you know, I personally find it a little bit more difficult these days to separate all that kind of stuff from just the football itself. Or when it's on, can you just immerse yourself in that?
I find it difficult to put it to one side, partly because usually I go to major tournaments to cover Italy, and Italy are not there this time around. So I'm not kind of, I don't have my head in the sand. I'm not as blinkered as I have been at other, say, European Championships and World Cups. Already you see, you know, people using the World Cup for political gain or proper reasons of propaganda. We saw, the Egypt side sort of based in Grozny in Chechnya, and, photo ops with Ramadan Kadyrov, which, you know, have, you know, provoked outrage, and rightly so, from Human Rights Watch. And, I think that's, in some respects, the disappointing about the allocation of these tournaments, that, you know, these things should be foreseen, really, and maybe should be part of the criteria for allocation. But, you know, it's not the first time. It would be naive to be say it's not the first time that the World Cup has been held not by a questionable country, because Russia is a great country. I studied Russian music literature and art in my final year at university.
Wow.
It's just the administration, just as, you know, we saw in 78. You know, Argentina is a wonderful country that I love going to, but, you know, at that time had a regime, a junta that did some very, very unsavory things, to say the least. I'm one of those people who find it ludicrous when people say that, you know, you can, you know, sport and politics don't mix. Unfortunately, they do.
Mm. It's been a crazy kind of a week, hasn't it, with the Spanish situation, firing their coach on the on the eve of the World Cup, ahead of a game against Portugal, which is probably one of the tastiest games in the group stages. Who are your tip to go all the way in this particular tournament? It's always difficult, I know, because you know there are maybe four or five teams that could do it, but do you have your eye on anybody in particular?
It's interesting you should say that, Andrew, because my tip was Spain. I just thought Spain were being, I don't want to say underrated going into this tournament, but of the European contenders, they seem to be considered behind Germany, which I have no problem with, but France in particular. And you know, France seemed to me to be like a FIFA team, really, in that the video game, in that they generate so much hype because of the immense talent and depth of talent that they've got. But I have not seen France play particularly well or get me off the edge of my seat whenever I've watched them. It doesn't seem that Didier Deschamps knows his best team. There seems to be a lot of unresolved issues in terms of selection and system with them. Whereas I've watched Spain over the last couple of years under Lopetegui, and they dazzled, particularly against Italy at the Bernabeu and also against Argentina in March. And they look maybe not as good as they were in between 2008 and 2012. But they seem to have played at higher peaks of performance than certainly France, and I think one of the things that always gets overlooked about Spain, and we talk from England, and there's always the proclamation that the Premier League is the best league in the world. When Atletico Madrid won the Europa League, Real Madrid won the Champions League, Barcelona almost went undefeated in a ridiculously competitive championship.
Yeah,
this team's got that mix of winners from 2008 and 2010 and 2012, with guys who won things at junior level under Lopetegui, either with the under 19s or under 21s, but now I don't know what to think, because the game against Portugal, their first group stage game, is the trickiest of the group, and they go into it less than 48 hours after sacking their manager and appointing their sporting director. I don't know whether this would be like Arsenal sacking Unai Emery on the eve of the Premier League season and, I don't know, putting Raul Sanlehi in charge. I don't know, but
Ivan Gazidis.
It doesn't seem to strike me as a similar situation to what Italy found themselves in 82 and 2006, when there was scandal sort of on the eve of those tournaments, and it galvanized Italy and made the players take more responsibility and really focus their minds. But the fact is, those teams still had managers.
Yeah.
Managers with proven track records like Lippi or Berzot. I don't really know what to make of Fernando Hierro, who's, I think, only managed in the second division with Oviedo, who he took to eighth place. So, this might be quite a unique and unprecedented situation in which a team manages itself at a World Cup. I don't know.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how they do it. They have this incredible track record in recent tournaments. Just very finally, maybe it's just me not paying enough attention, but one of the things that's always been a trademark of England going into a World Cup has been this probably hysterical build-up of expectation that they can do something in the tournament. And I don't necessarily see that this time around. Whether that's just common sense or whether it's just being downplayed, what are your thoughts on what England might do under Gareth Southgate? I mean, we don't really know what kind of a manager he's going to be or how he's going to manage this team, but he does seem to have his feet very firmly on the ground.
Yeah, I would like to think that we don't overreact if England go out in the quarterfinals again. I think expectation now has been managed by seeing the golden generation under Sven-Goran Eriksson and to some extent even Fabio Capello. disappoint. But I think, yeah, this team is young. It's likable. It seems to be relatable by football standards. I know there's huge disparities in what your man on the street and what the likes of Harry Kane earn. But, you know, I think the FA and Gareth Southgate have done a really good job of opening this team up in ways that, you know, it's been closed off from us in the past. And, you know, I think that has generated some goodwill towards this this English side, which, you know, hasn't always been there. And, you know, I think they also play some interesting football. You've got a guy who's setting England up in a way we haven't seen him set up for a long time, you know, with three at the back, with players playing in unusual positions, but not necessarily out of position, you know, like Kyle Walker playing in a back three when we've seen him play as a fullback or a wingback. And, you know, Southgate's taken, you know, even though he seems quite unassuming, has taken some very gutsy, courageous decisions, you know, in phasing out Wayne Rooney, in basically telling a big personality like Joe Hart that he's not even good enough to be third choice goalkeeper. And there does seem to be a freshness about this England side, which, you know, again, you feel it's the start of something, you know, where you kind of look at this World Cup and think, yeah, it'd be great if they do something and they go far, but, you know, maybe we should have an eye on the European Championships in two years' time. The players also seem to just really like each other and get on, and are confident, more confident than the public, and unafraid to say it.
Yeah,
which again is kind of refreshing. So, I think in some respect, I would never say that the pressure is off with England, because although you were saying that expectations are lower and maybe media attention is a little bit more friendly than it has been in the past, there is already a kind of growing build up around it, which is kind of inevitable, you know, before a major tournament, which. I hope we don't build them up to knock them down. I hope we just we maintain this level of rationality, you know, whatever the results are.
Well, yeah, of course. I think that's the way that the English media have worked down through the years. And certainly in the current climate, there's no way that anything other than that might happen, given the way that football goes these days. But look, we'll see. Come on, Iceland. That's where I am. We'll see where they go. But James, listen, thanks a million for your time. It was very interesting and great to talk to you.
Pleasure.
If you're not already following James on Twitter, you can do so at James Horncastle, at James Horncastle. And of course, you'll see him on the European Football Show on BT Sport, and listen to him on podcasts and read him writing things about football, because, well, that is what he does, and he does it very well. So thank you again to James.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog. As I mentioned earlier, there's a brand new Arsenal history book out called Royal Arsenal Champions of the South, and I'm delighted to welcome to the show the three men involved with that, Mark Andrews, Andy Kelly, and Tim Stillman. Good evening to you guys.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Hello.
Andy, can I start with you? People would assume, I guess, given that Arsenal is a club with a long history that has been examined through the years many, many times, that perhaps there's nothing new to be found out about Arsenal. This book obviously tells us that there is. Could you just explain why you've gone into the depth you have about the formation of the club, the early years of the club, and why it is that you've gone back over some of the things that everybody assumed to be true?
Okay, well, it's something that happened about 7 years ago. I think it's towards the end of 2010. And I replied to a post on Tony Atwood's blog. And it was quite strange. It was about a specific game and a specific moment in Arsenal's history that was quite a lot, you know, quite a big part of the club's history. An FA Cup game against Derby in 1891. And the way that I am, I thought, well, I'd be very clever because I've got a match report for that game from an old newspaper, and I thought I'd send that to Tony. And there was one major item that was missing on the match report, and that was about one specific player that was said to have played in the game and been offered professional terms by Derby because he played so well for Arsenal. And at the time, Arsenal were an amateur club. And I couldn't quite work out why this player wasn't in the team lineup. And I went back and checked other records and other sources, and none of those had him in the lineup. And so, you know, it got me thinking, well, what's happened here? And there were other things that started to come out of the woodwork after that, and it seemed to be an awful lot of things eventually regarding the club's history before World War One. And so, eventually Mark joined in, and we worked out that an awful lot of the club's early history hasn't been recorded in the way that it should be.
That player that you refer to, Andy, did he actually play? Was it a case that he existed and just wasn't included, or what was the actual story with that?
He did exist, yeah, but he didn't play for Arsenal at that time. He wasn't an Arsenal player at that particular time. He was still playing up in Scotland. He joined Arsenal later on that year, at the beginning of the following season, after Arsenal had turned professional.
Right.
But if you were to read every other Arsenal history book, they would mention this player as having played in that game and being a catalyst for Arsenal turning professional, which at the time was a big, big thing in London because there were no other professional teams in London, and it's very much frowned upon.
Well, we might come to that, but Mark, I want to ask you about the process of finding out this kind of information, because now when we think about history, you want to find out about something, you go to the internet and you look up Wikipedia or you look up some various sources. When you're going back as far as you guys did, it needs to be a bit more forensic than that. Was that a big challenge in finding this information via old newspapers, scrapbooks, things like that?
Yes, and any history should be a bit more than Wikipedia, but
I know.
but basically, Andy had a colossal amount of work that he'd done. I wrote a thesis about Woolwich Arsenal in the crowd in 1990, and I was probably in at the same time as Andy was in there. whilst he was getting, he was basically working out his match report. So he was working on his match reports. I was working on the crowd and other bits and pieces. This is a Colindale. So basically most of the stuff that we picked up was Colindale. But there was lots and lots of other, papers there. But now a lot of the Colindale, now basically Colindale has now moved to King's Cross. So a lot of the papers that we accessed have gone online, but not all.
Right.
Basically we used Woolwich Gazette, Kentish Independent, South Eastern Herald, and the Kentish Mercury. They're the four main papers in Woolwich at the time, basically. And then we picked up other things like, you know, the club's got images of things and, like a cigarette box we found.
Yeah.
That was given to a referee. It's just you pick up something, you see something. Andy found the second oldest handbook from Woolwich because I found a report that said it's a handbook. And he went back, looked at different papers, and found the reference to the handbook. And we got it from a Cambridge University place. We didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
It's not out there, but it is if you dig deep enough. And the thing that we both said to each other was there's always an article by the man who is the founder, or the founder with Danskin, Elijah Watkins. And we both said, until we find that article, we're not going to write anything on this subject.
Right.
Because everything seemed to go back into what Watkins was saying from every book that you read.
Yeah.
And eventually we found it, so we could see firsthand what was going on. And that's when we started, writing this specific stuff.
Yeah, and you found the exact plot of land where Royal Arsenal played their first game. This was in December 1886. Sticking with you, Mark, how on earth did you do that?
Me and Andy were looking at it, and Andy found that I think it was the Galliford, where he lived, and he lived right next to a pub called the Great Eastern, and we were playing with Eastern Wanderers. So we put two together there, worked out that was it. It said they had a private bit of land. A bit of land is behind the pub, where the pub was.
Yeah.
It was before people have said it was the Glengall. It was near Glengall Road, but the Glengall bit comes in because a pub called the Glengall Arms was literally next door to the Great Eastern pub, and that's where the rivalry came. And that's where the name came from. It wasn't in Glengall Road, which is further up north of the Isle of Dogs. It's down in the south.
Right.
So we were doing that, looking at it, and then we were sort of thinking, yeah, that's good, And then I watched Time Team because I liked Old Phil and his act and everything, and that old stuff. And it was on Brunel, and it was basically about the Great Eastern ship, being built about 1850 odd, and there was an image, and I thought, that's interesting. Looked at it. And then we worked with an architect. I think he's an architect, or he does surveying. Called Matt Clark, who's an Arsenal fan, and he confirmed that the image that we'd given him, which was from the Time Team originally, but it was just an image from the Illustrated London News or something, was exactly from where you're standing. You look to the ship in the background being built, and in the foreground, there's the Great Eastern Pub, there's Glengall Arms, there's other bits and pieces and landmarks you can see on the ordnance maps. So it was that, really. I mean, we didn't find that picture first. That picture was the final part of the jigsaw. It was part of the process to get to there, and it was just by luck.
Yeah.
I was watching Time Team, basically.
Wow, amazing. History by accident, in a way. Well, I mean, look, that's how a lot of discoveries are made. We could call it the penicillin thing. I don't know how you do it. Anyway, Tim, part of the first part of the book is about deconstructing some of the myths that have existed about Arsenal's history and putting some of those things right. Can you give us maybe an example or two of some of the things that have been accepted wisdom or accepted as part of Arsenal's history that maybe weren't quite right or very different indeed?
Yeah. I think without giving too much away, obviously, about the book.
Of course.
I think... I think the one that really, really interested me was this fairly well-known story, and I say story advisedly, that Nottingham Forest, that the reason Arsenal play in red and white is because Nottingham Forest gave or gifted Arsenal some shirts which match the colour of Nottingham Forest shirts. Mm. And I think that's, you know, I don't think you have to be a massive Arsenal history nerd to have heard that. And I think I'm right in saying it might even say that in the Arsenal Museum. But basically, a lot of the research Mark and Andy have done calls that into quite big doubt. So it's kind of a, hesitate to say a myth, but it's a story that's definitely grown up, that's passed into history, that's kind of been accepted. It's something, you know, I've read, I think, every Arsenal history book going, and pretty much every single one says that, you know, one of the founding players, Fred Beardsley, played for Nottingham Forest. And so it's almost that put two and two together, oh, we must have red shirts because Fred Beardsley got them from his old club, Nottingham Forest. But there's very, very big reason to doubt that. And Mark and Andy have done some brilliant research to show that that's almost certainly not actually true. And if you buy the book, obviously, you'll see why. Yeah. But there were lots of things like this, really. I think one of the really kind of quite general things that surprised me when I came to, I suppose, kind of edit the book at first draft stage was some of the people who I really, really thought were the movers and shakers actually weren't as significant as I thought they were. So people like Jack Humble, for example, who, don't get me wrong, is very important in the formation of Arsenal Football Club. But I thought, from reading what I'd read, I thought he was far more prominent than he actually was. I thought that, you know, he was like, him and David Danskin were like the main guys, and every history you read kind of says that. But actually, some people I'd only read about kind of in the margins are actually far, far more important and, you know, far more significant in shaping some of the things that happened. And honestly, some of the drama as well that happens in those early years, because this really does move very, very quickly from something, some, you know, basically some guys from work put a football team together, and within like 6 or 7 years it's a professional football team. It's the speed with which things move, and the kind of the drama and the tension really, like, really, really hits you. And I don't think I'd ever read anything before that really brought that out.
Right.
So I think those are some of the things that really surprised me.
Andy, I mean, Tim's talking about drama there, and over the last number of years we've seen some boardroom issues at Arsenal and people fighting for a majority share of the club, and that was true back then as well.
Very much so, yeah. We sort of like wrote about this in a previous book that we've written, which covered the time after the book, the Royal Arsenal book. And even when we were writing that book, we were constantly finding out stuff that was happening that no one had ever recorded before in Arsenal's history. And there was a massive power struggle that started round about 1890 and came to a head in 1893, you know, which the cup could have been pulled apart and gone out of existence. And like I say, we wrote about this before, but now we have found more information that takes it back further than we originally thought it started. We'd originally thought it started around about 1892. It actually goes back to 1890 when we moved into a ground called the Invicta Ground, which was purpose-built ground. It was probably one of the best grounds in England at the time. And like I say, although it started early in 1892 and 1893, you know, if you think that Kroenke and Usmanov is big, you should read what we've written about what happened in 1892 and 93 again.
What would have happened if one side had not won out, or if the other side had ultimately failed? Well, I mean, could the trajectory of the club been very different?
Well, the losing side, if you want, actually did try and form their own football team. They were called Royal Ordnance Factories. And within 3 years of being formed, they went out of business. They went bust.
Right.
So that could have happened to Arsenal, and they played in blue and white, which is far, far worse.
Oh, God, no. We can't have any of that. Mark, the move from amateur to professional was difficult, apparently. Could you explain a little bit why that was and what the significance of Arsenal or Royal Arsenal becoming professional at that period in the club's history?
Well, I mean, as Tim alluded to, we started off in 1896. A few workmen got together from the cricket team, set things up, and then within 5 years they'd become a professional outfit. So it was pretty major, really. I mean, Arsenal had steadily worked their way up to 1889-90. That season, they won every local trophy that they could win, except for the London Senior Cup. And then the next year, 91, they won it. So really, it's they'd done everything they could do to win the FA Cup effectively, yeah, as an amateur team. Where could they go? All the information, all the stuff beforehand that said, we were kicked out of this, kicked out of that. We weren't. Arsenal resigned from the LFA and London FA and the Kent FA, because, you know, they weren't amateur anymore, and the Kent FA and the London FA were amateur. The reason Arsenal did it was they kept on. I mean, in the book we've got about six or seven incidents of where the papers suddenly say, "Oh, someone from Bolton's down, you know, at the Ordnance, looking around, wonder what they could be doing." Mm. Sort of sarcastically saying, "Yeah, we know you're trying to nick our players." You know, there was a lot of the northern clubs that came down did try to take players away. You know, I mean, when, and as Andy said before, in the Derby game, whilst Boost wasn't playing, they certainly tried to take two or three of our players. They didn't go, but they tried it.
About protecting the players that they had.
I think yes. I mean, there is sort of in some of the AGMs and half yearly AGMs, there's allusions to that. Is that, you know, if we don't go professional, then we'll lose all our players because they'll all be taken up by professional players. And also the other thing was, with Arsenal, most of the players, or virtually all the players at that time, were also members of the Ordnance. They also worked in the factory.
Yeah.
So they had the protection. If they didn't carry on with football, they still earned a very good wage because most of them were skilled workers in the Arsenal. So for the players, it was a win-win, really. You know, and quite often, some of the players who were there beforehand, before they turned professional, carried on, were still paid by the Ordnance, but not by the club. It's a very strange symbiosis between the two. Well, it's not strange, but it's obvious because, you know, that's Arsenal's name, wasn't it? Arsenal.
Well, Royal Arsenal. Arsenal. Yeah, exactly.
I think that was another one of my favourite parts of the book. They call it shamateurism, or they called it that at the time, where basically, I'm going to exaggerate for effect here, but did you ever see that early Simpsons episode where Mr. Burns really wants to win a baseball game against like a rival nuclear plant?
Yeah.
And he starts like hiring Major League Baseball players to work in the nuclear plant. That's kind of, obviously not to that extent, but that's kind of what Arsenal were doing, kind of hiring suspiciously good footballers to work in the factory. And so, you know, but again, before they went professional, they were kind of professional in all but name, really. But I mean, that's another one of the things, isn't it, that actually they had quite good jobs already, and Arsenal could really attract good players because they could give the men good work, particularly because, you know, this is the time of the empire and, you know, war is big business. It's quite regular business for England at this time. So there's always work in an armaments factory. So Arsenal kind of had a little bit of a hook. It's really good work. And it's fascinating kind of thinking about all of that and thinking about, for some players, whether they even wanted to go to be professional footballers, because, you know, working in a factory was such good work in the 1880s that actually being a footballer wasn't necessarily a better career at that stage. And in fact, you know, being an armaments worker, certainly a more long-term career, and, you know, the wages were probably better. It was skilled work. So it's really fascinating, like, looking at the politics of that side of it for the workers as well as the guys that ran the club.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably, you probably had more protection as a worker in an armaments factory even back then than you did as a professional footballer. As we know, players didn't necessarily get looked after very well until much, much later on than that.
There's, there's actually a prime example of that in the book, in the sort of player that Arsenal could, or the Royal Arsenal could attract. And that was one of Preston's invincibles. So the Preston team that won the first ever football league in 1888-89 and the FA Cup, the first team to win the double, one of their players was actually came down to work in the Royal Arsenal, and he eventually played for Arsenal.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, that's how you get in the team. Be good at making guns and bombs and stuff like that. Andy, tell me about Red Shirt. He was the first ever opinion columnist, and he came from Dublin. Strange parallel to this particular podcast. But so tell me about him, because that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, so he wrote in one of the papers that even the papers talk. Going back to this rivalry that almost split the club apart, there were two newspapers, one of which was in favour of one of the groups, and Red Shirt wrote for one of the other papers that was in favour of the group that eventually won. But he was very, very opinionated, and he would always speak his mind and cause uproar at the general meetings and other meetings. And, you know, he stayed on, went to the club, changed its name to Woolwich Arsenal.
And, he was there throughout that period, was he, and causing ructions with his writing?
He was, very much so, yeah. And like I say, he would write in favour of the team that he, or the group that he eventually won. So he was he seemed to pick the right side.
He also in after Royal Arsenal, Woolwich Arsenal, he was also a ringleader of causing all of the committee to resign, or the board resigned, over some. I can't remember what it was about, actually, but it was typical of him. He got everyone wound up. They all resigned, and then they said, "Oh, well, not really." So they all come back on the board, and everything was fine. But he was a real character. I mean, he was in the army. That's how he come to Woolwich. His name was George Steed.
George Steed from Dublin.
George Steed. Yeah.
I was just going to say, so the power rests with you, Andrew. Now, I think the gauntlet has been thrown down very emphatically there.
Yeah, who am I to deny history being laid in my lap like this? Anyway, guys, look, the book is fascinating. It's called Royal Arsenal, Champions of the South. It's out now, available through Legends Publishing. We've got a copy to give away. I'll give people details of that. But look, best of luck with it, and thanks a million for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, if you would like to win yourself a signed copy of that fascinating book, all you have to do is answer the following question. Just tell me what year Royal Arsenal was formed. Not that difficult. Send your answer, please, to competition@arsblog.com. That's competition@arsblog.com. We'll pick a winner, we'll announce it on next week's show, and you will get yourself a signed copy of the book, which is Royal Arsenal, Champions of the South, by Andy Kelly, Mark Andrews, and Tim Stillman. So look, that's just about that. We'll see what the weekend brings in terms of signings and transfers and everything else. We'll talk about all that with James on the Arscast Extra on Monday, so make sure you join us for that. In the meantime, you can, of course, go World Cup crazy, watching football at strange times of the day and night, annoying people in your family who want to use the TV, but you go, no, sorry, football's on. Actually, that doesn't really work anymore, does it? Because people just go, oh, yeah, fuck you. Picking up my phone, picking up my tablet, picking up my laptop, whatever it is. I'm going to go and watch Netflix in my room, and you can't stop me, old man, watching football on the sofa with a beer at 11 o'clock in the morning. Whatever way you want to experience the World Cup, hope you have a good time. I will catch you on the Arscast Extra on Monday with James. Until then, take it easy. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Good evening. This is Gianni Infantino, President of FIFA, and I would like to assure you that despite what you might have heard earlier in this podcast, my genitals are absolutely fine. They are perfect, perfect genitals. No problem, no harm has come to my genitals from the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia or Russian President Vladimir Putin, because basically they don't like that kind of thing in their countries. So, neither do we at FIFA. Despite the fact that we preach inclusivity and football being a game for everybody, if you have enough money, we can just look over here for a little while. Until such time as it is in our interest to look back the other way. If you want entire World Cup played in rainbow shirts, cough up the cash, we do that for you, no problem. But my ghoulies, perfect. Do not worry about my ghoulies. My ghoulies are fantastic. People say to me, I have never seen ghoulies anything like those before. They are such fantastic ghoulies, amazing ghoulies. But not here in Russia, no. Or Qatar. Maybe after. Depends on the money.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.